it was really quite phenomenal to get that sort of access to the man who led the whole thing. So he led the church department for the last 10 years of East Germany's existence.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com. When the Berlin Wall came down, the files of the East German secret police, the much-dreaded Stasi, were opened and read. And among the shocking stories revealed was that of the Stasi's infiltration of the Lutheran Church. The Lutheran Church was the only semi-free space in East Germany where those who rebelled against the regime could find a way of living at least a little out of the government's grip. Do you know how much $3 is in British pounds? It's 76 pence. Which equals about 20 pence per episode if you sign up as a monthly financial supporter of the podcast. Higher amounts are welcome too, but it's very straightforward and you can stop whenever you want. Plus, monthly supporters get the fantastic Cold War Conversations coaster too. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. Recent supporters include David Bambury, Daisy Birkenhead, Steve Cairns, Tim Marks, and Holly Mead. Many thanks to all our financial supporters who keep Cold War Conversations on the air. If that's not your cup of tea, then leave a written review in Apple Podcasts or share us on social media. Back to today's episode, Elizabeth Brohr tells us the real-life cloak-and-dagger story of how the Stasi infiltrated the churches in East Germany. We welcome Elizabeth to our Cold War conversation. Just before we start, I want to tell you that we have three free copies of Elizabeth's book to give away. So do check out the show notes, which will show as a link in your podcast app for how to win a copy. One of the first questions I wanted to ask is aside from, you know, the story hadn't been told before, how did your interest in East Germany come about?
Well, it started very early in 1988 when I was 14 years old. So now I'm giving my age away. But my grandparents, who thought I should see something of the world, they had taken me to West Germany previously, and it didn't do much for me. So I'm Swedish by nationality, and West Germany wasn't really that different. But then they took me to East Germany, including East Berlin, and that was really sort of a Damascus experience to see this country that was so close, so geographically close, but yet so completely different, and guards and soldiers everywhere, and this particular smell that East Germany had, and it was all very fascinating. And so this was in 1988, and I resolved to go back, which happened to be the next year when Germany reunited. So we were there in the summer of 1988, and it wasn't clear that the war would come down, and it came down, and then I returned by myself for the reunification and subsequently quite frequently, and then of course I lived there.
Right. And why was the Stasi particularly interested in the Lutheran Church?
So the Stasi, as you know, its mission was to basically keep the country compliant, to make sure that there were no major expressions or even minor expressions of opposition against the regime. And that's why I had all these agents and a great number of officers. The reason it was so interested in East Germany's churches and the Lutheran Church in particular is that the Lutheran Church, so Protestants, was very strong. It was the country's largest denomination, very strong numerically and also very strong politically. Lutherans were politically active, where they weren't afraid to express their opinions. And so you had this really sort of a stronghold of opposition within the country, even as the country was founded. And on top of that, of course, these churches had connections abroad, primarily to West Germany, but really around the world, including Western countries, the US, Western European countries. So that was a sort of a major headache for the government, and it couldn't completely ban those links because then it would have been totally ostracized internationally. So it had to sort of infiltrate these churches, or not sort of, it had to infiltrate the churches to make sure that the Stasi knew everything that was going on and could prevent expressions of dissent.
Right, right. And I think what brings this book alive is that amazingly, you managed to be able to speak to Joachim Wiegand, who was the director of the church department of the Stasi. How did you get him to talk?
It was quite miraculous, really. So I've started doing the research for the book and doing initial interviews, thinking that it was almost impossible to get to talk to him or indeed any of his officers. But I wrote him a letter asking if he would be interested, and miraculously he replied, and I think and said that he would be happy to talk to me. And I think the reason for that is that I'm not West German, and East Germans are sensitive about West Germans because they feel West Germans are often condescending or they have prejudices about them. And I'm not East German either, so I don't have that sort of baggage either. But I know a lot about East Germany. I think maybe he felt I was a neutral observer who would approach the interview without any prejudice. And I hope that's what I did.
Right, right. And I'm interested to know, I mean, your first meeting, what was that like? With knowing the sort of reputation of the Stasi and a senior officer at that as well.
It was really quite human. So he had, as Germans often do, he had invited me to his house. And so he lives in the apartment he has lived in with his wife for over four decades near the former Stasi headquarters in Lichtenberg. And so he invited me there, and it's a very modest East German style apartment. And so I arrived and he and his wife offered me coffee, and if you can imagine East German apartments with the sort of furniture that basically all these German apartments had, his apartment is like that still. And so we sat down in the living room, and he explained what he would be willing to talk about, which was everything except one thing, and that was that he wouldn't give me the names of agents whose identity has not yet been revealed. Anything else he was willing to talk about. And it was really phenomenal to get that sort of access to the man who led the whole thing. So he led the church department for the last 10 years of East Germany's existence, and worked in the department for many years previously, and was rising through the ranks.
Yeah, I mean, incredible. And it makes the book, because although you've managed to speak to some of the other unofficial collaborators and, you know, some of the other staff, hearing from him and also hearing about the technique as to how he recruited and just his, I mean, it's almost like a confession. He was 87, I think, when you met with him, wasn't he?
Well, so we started meeting when he was 83, and now he has just turned 87. So we met many times over these years, and for several hours each time. So, yes, I think, as you say, it was almost like a confessional. And I think it's important for people like him to speak. And the tragedy of East Germany's 40-year history is that the people who ran the country are not willing to speak because they think that everybody's prejudiced against them. So I think it's great for me and I hope for the readers of the book as well, but also for future generations to hear from somebody who played such an important role, because at 87 years old, he won't be around for much longer.
You're absolutely right. And that's one of the objectives of the podcast, is to capture these stories of the Cold War, before they are lost. And this one is particularly a fascinating one. So I mentioned that he talks about recruitment techniques. I mean, this wasn't, they weren't working on these pastors or these religious leaders through blackmail in the main, were they? This was the examples, or many of the examples you've got in the book, it's an active form of collaboration, either from an ideological level or from a material gain level.
Yes, that's right. And I think many people, when they think about the countries behind the Iron Curtain, they imagine blackmail and pressure. The Church Department works in a completely different way, at least in for most of East Germany's existence. They started with a sort of Stalinist approach where they persecuted people, but then it was more of a soft glove approach, and so I help you, you help me, and it was phenomenally cunning. So they had this network of informants who fed them information about other people, and they collected every piece of information you could imagine from publicly available sources, from their existing informants or agents, you might call them, and based on that they got a very good picture of people they might like to approach. And so they did that knowing a great deal about them, what they were about, what their opinions were, and maybe if they had chips on their shoulder or things that weren't going very well for them, or maybe problems in their marriage, what have you, or career challenges. They knew all of that, so they could approach these prospective agents who were often pastors of all ranks, from lowly sort of junior pastors and theology students all the way up to bishops. They could approach them with all that information and tailor the conversation in such a way that the prospective agent, so the clergyman, felt that he was talking to a like-minded soul, essentially.
Yes, yeah. I mean, it comes across in the book that Wiegand's approach is certainly not stick. There's a lot of carrot there, and there's a lot of empathy that he uses to get the agents to work for him. It's an interesting study in psychology to some degree.
Oh, it is, and it's so fascinating to see the sort of small things, really, sometimes that could convince clergymen to work for the Stasi. So they wanted goods from the West. That was enough in some cases to get them to sign on. They wanted career advantages. They wanted to be able to travel to the West. And in some cases, as you mentioned, they were committed communists. They wanted East Germany to survive. But that was a minority of cases. It was mostly about getting personal advantages and to be able to figured out in each case what is it that makes a person tick, what are his hang-ups, and then to employ that is really, I think, quite impressive. And you might say it's a very cunning and evil business, but Wiegand's business was to make sure that the Stasi knew everything that was going on in the churches, and he did it very well, and his officers.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, some of the examples you've got in the book, I mean, I was, you know, quite surprised at how little reward some of these people were looking for. I mean, there's one of the informers, I think he was looking for concert tickets.
That's right, yeah. And small things like that. Now, that particular pastor was also a very mediocre academic who wanted the Stasi to essentially make his career for him as a theology professor. And if the Stasi didn't come through with the sort of career moves that he wanted, he complained mightily. So it's not easy running agents, because it can be quite difficult because it's such a close personal connection. It's not transactional, or at least with the church department, it wasn't transactional. It was very strong relationships between the agents and their case officers. In some cases, that worked very well, and in some cases, the agents were quite needy.
Yeah, and you know, in that example, I think he was looking for promotion and greater influence. Yet the challenge the Stasi had is that the church knew there were some informers in their midst, and by a mediocre priest being moved up, that would immediately be a potential red flag that, he's in the pay of the Stasi, I guess.
Oh, absolutely. So even in East Germany, it was a meritocracy to some extent. And yes, the government appointed people. But if a terrible academic all of a sudden turned up with a chair in theology, it was as the occupant of a chair in theology, then it would be perfectly clear to everybody that he didn't get it on merit.
Yeah. Yeah. I think one of the most interesting characters in there is Bambowski. Can you just tell us a little bit about him and how he was recruited and how he grew in stature as an agent?
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
He was an extremely fascinating agent and a flamboyant man. So when he started working for the Stasi, he was a traveling preacher, so not yet a Lutheran pastor, and his parents had been traveling actors. So he was very much in that sort of acting mold. And when he preached in these little parishes churches around the country, it was essentially a performance. People loved it, but it wasn't enough action for him. So he started working for the church department, and they soon realized that they, after he had passed the test on sort of minor assignments, they realized that they could use him to infiltrate Western organizations that smuggled literature to the East. And you'll recall that was a major activity in the West, donating money to books for people behind the Iron Curtain, and there were smuggling networks that smuggled them behind the Iron Curtain and then to the recipients. There was major activity, and the KGB in the Soviet Union couldn't figure out how these smuggling networks organized themselves. So when the Stasi had Bambowski and he made initial sort of attempts at infiltrating himself with this organization and it was successful, the Stasi and the KGB realized that he would be the man who could help them uncover these smuggling operations.
Yeah, and he appeared to have this easy charm to convince people that he was credible, because he sort of, almost blatantly just walks into the offices of some of these organizations and offers his services.
That's right, and so here is where the Stasi was so cunning. So Christian organizations rely on mutual trust. That's how they operate. So if you're a Christian organization in West Germany and the pastor from the East walks in and says, I'd love to help you, you're not going to challenge his identity or his motivation. You say, oh, that's brilliant, because it's really hard for us to get into East Germany with these bring these books into East Germany and store them and then have them collected. And here is this East German pastor who's volunteering to do it for us. And so it was a lot of naivete, but that's exactly what the Stasi knew. They knew that Western European Christians, American Christians were very naive in the way they operated. They trusted other Christians. And here he was, Pastor Bambowski, who took advantage of that.
Yes, indeed. And I think the other interesting piece that I noticed was with some of these pastors were sent abroad as well. I mean, there's the one example which springs to mind is the guy who was the church journalist.
Yes, he was.
Kapiski.
Jürgen Kapiski, that's right. He was a rare pastor agent who was a committed socialist, and that's That's why he signed up to work for the Stasi. So he's and he spoke to me for the book, and we had many, many conversations. And like Wiegand, he invited me to his home, and he told me everything. And what's interesting about him is that he felt out of place in these sort of church circles in East Germany, because he was not a pastor's son. He didn't come from a religious family. He came from a working family. So his parents worked on a collective farm. But he had decided to become a pastor, and he felt out of place. And of course, the Stasi picked up on that. So this officer turned up and said, well, I know you're interested in World War II history, and they chatted about that and discovered had mutual interests. And then after a while, Kapiska signed up to work for the Stasi, and he felt that he had, with this officer, that he had a strong personal bond and that they were confidants. And what's interesting is that that wasn't just a show. To this day, they are in touch, which really tells you something about the bonds that develop in this business.
Yeah, I guess so, because, I mean, obviously, I'm trying to imagine myself in those situations. And really, your controller, your agent controller, is the only person that you can confide in about what you're doing. So that bond must become very close.
Exactly. And if the relationship has been established not through coercion or blackmail, but with the agent, in this case, the pastor, walking into it and knowing what he's doing and doing so willingly, then it really becomes a probably the closest human relationship you can have, because even the ones that the pastors who were married, the pastor agents who were married, they couldn't talk about this with their wives. And in some cases they did, and Kapiska did, for example, but most pastors did not. So you've really only got this one person with whom you share everything, and that is your case officer.
And Kapiska, I mean, he was working internationally, and I was interested to see the sort of international assistance that the Stasi gave to other friendly intelligence organizations. I mean, we mentioned with Bambowski and the Bible smuggling, and the Stasi were very keen to score some points to show the KGB how good they were.
That's right. And Kapiska worked internationally. It wasn't set up that way, but it was discovered that he was just very good at making new contacts, and he was a church journalist, so he didn't spend most of his career sort of as a parish priest, but as a church journalist, and he traveled around the world, mostly in the Warsaw Pact area, but also in other countries. And was able to just make contact with these people who he met. And crucially, he spoke English, which was unusual for East Germans. And so the Stasi, of course, took advantage of that. Why wouldn't they? They spotted an opportunity. And that's how he happened to become sort of their eyes and ears with the Charter 77, even though foreign espionage was really the domain of the HVA, the foreign intelligence agency. The Stasi was able to collect information in the cases where its agents happened to be abroad anyway, and that's what Kapiska did. And because he was a pastor, he managed to create good contacts within Charter 77, and people spoke to him because, again, being a pastor engenders trust, and that's what the Stasi was able to exploit. And I think that's so interesting that he, being this unassuming church journalist, was able to get extremely good intelligence. I doubt many other spies were able to get from Charter 77.
Yeah, I mean, Charter 77 was a very close-knit group, and for him to be able to penetrate that group must have been sort of manna from heaven for the STB, the Czech equivalent of the Stasi. And what happened to these agents with the fall of the wall?
That was, as you might imagine, a very frightening moment. So they and the whole church department had obviously been working to prevent this very moment from happening. So because the Stasi knew exactly how things would transpire if opposition activities in churches got out of control. The Stasi knew they would lead to mass protests, and that could lead to the sort of upheaval that would bring the country down. And lo and behold, that's what happened in the autumn of 1989. And so when November came about in that year, it was clear that East Germany wouldn't survive. And so anybody who had been working undercover for the Stasi obviously feared what would happen to them. But they didn't fear it as much as you might think, because they had been promised that their identities would be protected. And they would be protected because the Stasi had promised to destroy all materials relating to them. But in the end, things happened so quickly that the Stasi just didn't have time to destroy all its files. And that's why we have this phenomenal resource today, the Stasi archive at the Gauck agency, that we are able to consult. It's only a partial record of the Stasi's complete files, because the officers did manage to destroy many files. But that's just to say that the agents were not as apprehensive or as panicked as one might think, simply because they were counting on the officers destroying their files.
Yeah. And it was interesting reading that, what a lot of the officers did was concentrate on their current active agents. So they started with those files. So trying to find information on sort of activities in the last 2 years of East Germany is quite difficult.
That's right. So, for example, in the case of Bambowski, it's a phenomenally complete record up until 1986, and then there's nothing. And so that, of course, raises the question, what happened in those final years of East Germany? Which agents have not been uncovered? How many people are there out there who have quite dark secrets that the wider public might like to know about, and we'll never know? But fortunately, we've got the files from the previous years. But just imagine the situation when it became clear to the Stasi that East Germany was not going to survive, and they frantically began shredding files. And when it wasn't enough to shred, they began just ripping them up by hand. I would have been loved to be a fly on the wall to see that happening as the country was collapsing around them.
Yes, indeed. I mean, I've tried shredding old bank statements, and that takes long enough, let alone just shelves and shelves of files. Now, just going back to Vigan, the head of the church department, I get the impression that you got quite close to him. I mean, he was lending you books, and he was, as you said at the start, he trusted you to tell his story in an accurate way.
Yes, he did, and I feel privileged that he trusted me, because even if he had wanted to read a draft of the book, he wouldn't have been able to because he doesn't speak English. So yeah, he trusted me, and he actually, this is quite sort of explosive information that he gave me, and really thinks that he hasn't told anybody before, anybody outside the Stasi before, and thinks that haven't been known until now. And so he just had to trust me that I would use that information responsibly, and I hope I did. And I just think it's so important that we preserve this part of East German history for posterity, because what we've had so far is the stories from victims of the Stasi, and that's very, very important. But that's only part of the story, and to know how the Stasi operated, how the officers went about their daily work, how they organized themselves, how they planned what they were going to do to achieve their goals, all of that, that's not part of it. It's not documented in the files. And obviously, victims wouldn't know any of that information. So it's crucial that we know, we hear from the officers as well. And so that's why I feel extremely privileged that Vigan trusted me.
Do, Did he give any indication that he might be concerned as to what his former colleagues would feel about him telling the story?
He didn't. And I get the sense that they are a brotherhood, and it's and where they are just very good friends still. And I think he felt that he spoke for them as well, even though he just told his own story. But he feels a responsibility for them because he feels that they've been poorly treated by post-unification Germany and that they've been vilified. So I think the things that he told me are things that he would not be embarrassed to admit to them that he had told me. And it's quite fascinating. So I met him, as I mentioned, many times over a number of years. And a couple of times he had just come back from a meeting with his officers, or he was going off to a meeting with his officers. And it's really quite human to see here they are now, elderly gentlemen, and they still get together. They work together in a country that people would call unjust, dictatorial, and so forth. But they still have this human bond between them, and they get together to celebrate each other's birthdays and just to spend time together.
Yeah, and when you were talking to him, what did he say about the end of the GDR? Was he bitter about the fact that the socialist project had failed?
He was not, because he knew exactly the unhappiness that was spreading around the country, across the country. And he said that by the summer of 1989, he realized it was over. And he said all this talk about, you know, a thousand-year country, that was all a dream, and it just couldn't survive. He said it was a good idea, but it just couldn't. East Germany was a good idea, but it wasn't meant to survive. So he was sort of resigned to the fact that the country had failed. And I think it's so interesting because he probably knew better than most through his work exactly what people were thinking, what they were saying, what they wanted. And the tragedy for East Germany was that what they wanted was so completely different from what the regime was willing or able to offer them. And so Wiegand obviously brought the findings from the Church Department, brought them to the government regularly. But even if the government had wanted to act on them, it wouldn't have been able to, because that would have meant doing away with the government itself.
Yeah, effectively what they did on the evening of the 9th of November 1989 was, yeah, exactly what he'd been hearing for years, yeah. And it resulted in the end of the country. One of the things I found interesting is that transition from East Germany, you know, into the Wende and the reunification. And I was fascinated by the fact that he sort of made a career to some degree by working in real estate. And it sort of came to me listening or reading was he applying those same psychological techniques that he applied to recruit his agents in a sales environment? And I imagine he was, because he'd learned that persuasiveness and that empathy that works so well in sales.
Well, that's an interesting thought. He probably was quite good. So, but the reality why so many Stasi officers became real estate agents is that it was the only job available to them. So they were really cast out when the Stasi ceased to exist. And what do you do if you are sort of mid-career or towards the end of your career, and this is the only thing that you know how to do? You're very good at it, but your employer no longer exists, and your skills are no longer needed in any shape or form. So what was needed and what boomed in those early years of post-unification Germany in the East was real estate, because all these East Germans hadn't been able to buy properties were all of a sudden buying and the lots was being built. And capitalism, for all its shortcomings, is, I think, blind to ideology. And so anybody who wanted to sell real estate could make a living doing so. And so you had, as a result, all these Stasi officers who couldn't find work anywhere else, making a living doing a sort of a very capitalist thing, which is to sell real estate.
Yeah. No, it's really incredible. I just imagine that a lot of them got jobs in security or areas like that rather than real estate.
Yes, but there are also some really quite sad cases. So, for example, Wiegand in the book mentions one of his officers who was extremely capable, who had studied in the Soviet Union, which is what some of these Germans were allowed to do, and obviously spoke fluent Russian, had a PhD and so forth, and he couldn't find any sort of jobs after reunification, but ended up driving a taxi. And you can feel the professional pain in Wiegand's voice talking about his officer. He clearly feels responsibility for these officers whom he directed for so many years, and he feels a responsibility for them even now. And it pained him that this very capable man had been forced to drive a taxi. Now, people will say that serves him right because he served an unjust country. But from Wiegand's perspective, that it is a tragedy that capable, intelligent professional can't find work.
Yes. And he, there's so many bits of this book that I found really interesting, but another area was this thing about penalty pensions. So these ex-Stasi officers were not awarded their full pension that they would have been if East Germany had survived, and were awarded some sort of penalty pension. So what was that, sort of like a subsistence level?
Yes, that's right. So senior government officials, East German government officials, and also Stasi officers receive a reduced pension. And that is essentially a reflection of the fact that they are seen as having participated in unjust activities. And I guess there is some justification to that. But so Wiegand talks about penalty pension because he feels that it's professionally unjust that somebody who has worked his whole life within an organization fulfilled his job duties the way they were expected from him, that he should not receive pension for having done that work. And this is the tragedy of those who were part of East Germany, who worked for the government in some way, and even who didn't work for the government, that they spent their whole life assuming that the country would last, because you don't go about your life thinking, well, this country might not last, so I'm not going to care about it. You have to figure out how to live your life in a country such as it is. And then all of a sudden it no longer exists and you have to completely redo your life. And I saw that myself when I was a student in the former East in the early to mid 90s. All these middle-aged people who all of a sudden had nothing. Yes, they received social benefits from the government, but they had worked for their whole lives in whatever jobs they had been working in, and all of a sudden those jobs no longer existed, and that was their identity. They didn't know what to do with themselves, and how do you completely change the direction of your life? Yes, you might choose to do it, but these people, it was imposed on them. And yes, I'm sure almost everybody wanted this new and freer society, but still it was very, very painful for lots of people. And also the prospect of never having a proper job again.
Indeed. There's a really strong cast of characters in this book, obviously centered around Wiegand. And what comes across with you interviewing Wiegand and writing about him is there's much more of a nuanced character there that you would normally expect from what people might imagine as the archetypal Stasi officer?
Yes, and I'm glad to hear that you think that comes across, because yes, most people have this idea that Stasi officers, like KGB officers, like any secret police officers in the East, that they were brutal, that they were unsophisticated. Well, actually, well, speaking now only for the Stasi Church Department, they were not. So they were all working class men, and it's interesting to see what sort of jobs they had trained for before becoming Stasi officers. So they were welders, they were factory workers, they were manual workers, but then they were trained as Stasi officers. And they developed this really sophisticated understanding of how, in this case, how churches operated. And it's really quite surprising that they managed to do that, not coming from that sort of world at all and not having that background. And so with Wiegand, his background was that he, like so many other Germans his age, he had lost his father, so he grew up with a single mother, and they were very poor, and he worked as a farmhand. And then one day a man came and asked him if he wanted to work for peace. Well, who doesn't want to work for peace, especially if you come from the region of Dresden, which, as you know, Dresden was completely bombed out during World War II. Yeah. So if somebody says, do you want to work for peace? I think we would all say, yeah, I want to work for peace. But so people like him, or Joachim Wiegand in particular, since you asked about him, managed to develop this very sophisticated understanding of both how churches work, but also about human nature, just simply by working with people all the time. And he told me about some of the early mistakes he made as a young officer, and he learned from them, and then became or improved his game as a result. And so I think it's really important to see that it's, or to understand, and I hope people understand from the book, that the reason that people, especially pastors in this particular case, worked for the Stasi is that actually officers like Wiegand were able to win them over simply by being fellow human beings who obviously were able to zero in on the respective pastor's weakness. But it was a mix of, yes, being an officer, but also develop this relationship with each person they approached. And that's why so many officers, and especially Wiegand, still has good relationships with the pastors that worked for them. You could think that those pastors would denounce them the moment the wall fell. No, they didn't. And so Kapiske, for example, is still in contact with his case officer, as I mentioned. And so I think one really touching moment or touching part of this story is the Festschrift that was written for Wiegand's 80th birthday. So Festschrift is obviously an academic tradition where when an academic, usually a professor, has a major birthday, his fellow academics write a book in his honor with, you know, they write a chapter each, and it's called a Festschrift. Well, when Wiegand turned 80, a number of his former colleagues and former agents got together and published a Festschrift for him. I think that's such a touching moment. And you could say, oh, these are all, evil people, and why would you celebrate somebody who led a Stasi department? But if you look at it from their perspective, these are people who still respect each other, appreciate each other, and especially in this case, respect him. And so they wrote this Festschrift for him.
Do you think that he applied some of his techniques on you in the course of the years that you met with him in order to, you know, get a positive hearing about his story?
Well, that's a question I think anybody would ask themselves. I don't think so. He's not particularly charming. He's a very factual man. And so I would ask him questions, and he would recount in a factual manner how things happened. And he wasn't evasive when I asked him questions. The only thing, as I mentioned earlier, was the only ground rule he had laid out was that he wouldn't reveal names of people who hadn't already been revealed to be Stasi agents. And sometimes I tried to trick him into revealing such names, but he wouldn't. With everything else, he was forthcoming and explained things in a factual manner. Then I went back and double checked as much as I could. With other people. So for example, if he had said something, I would then bring it up with Wiegand, with Kapiska, to see if he, without telling him that Wiegand had said it, I would bring it up with Kapiska to see if he said something that confirmed that. And that was, in every case I tried that, it was the case. And it was even the case when I asked victims such as, Wolf Kurtke was an early victim, and he remained in the Stasi sites because he was an opposition-minded pastor. And he even confirmed some things that Wiegand had said, because he had noticed them from his victim perspective. So there is always the risk that he was being deceptive, but having dealt a lot with intelligence and intelligence history over the years, I'm as certain as I think I can be that he was honest with me.
Yeah, I wasn't, you know, doubting your, you know, your ability there. It's just interesting, you know, that you'd thought that yourself and were trying to use multiple sources in order to verify some of the information that he was giving.
Yeah, and
you.
I think it's something that one should be aware of.
That's good journalism.
Yeah, it is something that one should be aware of going into a situation like that. That the person might not might want to deceive you, but I felt that he did not. And I think, you know, at this age, he is keen to. Pass on to posterity what happened, so that there will be some sort of resource. Also for his family, I mean, it's difficult for families of Stasi officers to sit down and say, "Well, what did you do in your career?" Because it's uncomfortable, and so I think this will also serve as a resource for his own family, his son, grandchildren, great grandchildren, and his son knows a bit more, of course, but his grandchildren, great grandchildren don't really know a great deal, because it's just too uncomfortable to sit down and have these conversations.
Yes. Yeah. One of the most interesting chapters I found was the postscript chapter that talked about, you know, the end of East Germany. And as we said, Wiegand is a very nuanced character, and the story of the basement in the headquarters, where there were 30,000 Bibles that they'd confiscated, and in the dying days of East Germany, he puts them on a train and on trucks to be sent to the Soviet Union.
Yeah, that's such a powerful story. So he had all these Bibles that his department had confiscated, because they had Bambowski, their agent, who was transporting them. And so part of Bambowski's job was to reveal to the Stasi, and through them to the KGB, who the recipients in the Soviet Union were. So he had to deliver some of the books to them, otherwise it would have become suspicious. But he also skimmed many of the books. And so what do you do with books? Well, the Stasi put them in its basement sort of for the time being. And then when 1989 rolled around, it was it had 30,000 Bibles in the basement. And so Wiegand had to decide what to do with them. And it's such a human moment where he stands there and has 30,000 Bibles. And here's a man who is he is an atheist to this day, and has obviously seen the ugliest face of Christianity, where I think that the people he dealt with it would be very difficult to respect. And yet he doesn't shred the Bibles. He sends them to their intended destination, which is really a very human thing to do.
Yes. Yeah. Very, very surprising, but very human. Elizabeth, that has been a really interesting chat. I really appreciate you coming on the podcast.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and I'm glad you enjoyed the book.
I did indeed. The book is God's Spies, the Stasi's Cold War Espionage Campaign Inside the Church. There will be links in the show notes. I recommend it. It's a book I enjoyed, and particularly enjoy unknown or little known stories of the Cold War, and this absolutely fits the bill. So thank you very much, Elizabeth, for putting this together for us. If you like what you're hearing, sign up to our email list at coldwarconversations.com. And we have further photos, videos, and information on this episode in our show notes, which will show as a link in your podcast app. Don't forget, if you'd like to get one of those Cold War Conversations coasters, help keep us on the air, then head over to coldwarconversations.com/donate. And if you can't wait for the next episode, do visit our Facebook discussion group, where listeners just like you continue the Cold War conversation. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thank you very much for listening. It is really appreciated. Goodbye. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.